Only 7% of children in the UK go to private schools. The other 93% are in state schools. But 7 out of 10 military officers and top judges are privately educated. 6 out of 10 senior doctors and a third of MPs. And inevitably it means that this very small percentage who attend private schools grow up with a sense of entitlement, and I'm sure they'd be the first to acknowledge that. This sense that they deserve a place at the top table, the top jobs. But a sense of entitlement is not limited to the privately educated. I mean, you may not have been to Eton, but as the sort of 21st century middle class educated people that most of us are, we feel, don't we, that we deserve certain privileges. A good job, a decent salary, comfortable housing, respect, quick service, good healthcare, a high standard of living. And this sense of entitlement, which I think we all have, it can easily shape how we relate to God. How easily we feel that it's not just society that owes us, but it's God who owes us as well. Because of who we are, because of what we've done. We think that I deserve God accepting me. I deserve my place in heaven. I deserve God looking after me and life sort of working out well for me. I deserve God providing me with what I want and forgiving me when I do wrong. I deserve these things. All this is simply what I deserve. In fact, God is pretty lucky to have me on his team, let's face it. So easily we think, and how wrong we are. God owes us nothing. We deserve nothing. Any blessings we enjoy from God are undeserved gifts. And so rather than feeling entitled, we should feel very, very thankful to God. We should be overflowing with thankfulness for his goodness to us. And this passage in Mark's Gospel will help us to see that. So Mark 7:24-8:10. These three stories about Jesus meeting a Gentile woman, a deaf man, a hungry crowd, they will expose how undeserving we are and how misguided any sense of entitlement really is. They reveal who we really are, which might be quite different to how we see ourselves at the moment. And so we maybe need to get ready for a bit of a shock. The morning after the Oprah Winfrey interview with Harry and Meghan this past week, the Times newspaper showed this cartoon you may have seen. So this couple about to watch the program, and on the screen it said, "Oprah, warning, you are about to spill wine on your sofa," because of the shocking revelations that are about to come. And this passage in Mark's Gospel could, I think, do with a similar caution. How do you see yourself? Probably not in the way that our first point does. Our first point you'll see on the sheet is that we are the dogs who have been fed. Let's take a closer look. In verse 24, Jesus heads off on a shocking journey, shocking for a Jew at the time at least. So he goes away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. That's at the top of the map there on the left. Crosses the border, he heads deep into Gentile territory, that is non-Jewish territory, into what is modern-day Lebanon. Now this port city of Tyre, it had a long history of hostility to Israel. It had been home of the infamous Jezebel, if you remember her, and it had been condemned by the Old Testament prophets. There's a guy, a Jewish historian called Josephus, and he called Tyre notoriously our bitterest enemies. So these places, Tyre and Sidon, they represented paganism at its most extreme. And so for Jesus as a Jew to go there was unprecedented and shocking. And the shocking journey leads to this shocking encounter. He's met by a woman whose daughter was demon-possessed. So if you look at verse 26, it emphasizes, now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth. She falls down at his feet. The last person to do that in Mark's gospel was Jairus, a synagogue ruler. What a contrast. A Pharisee would not have gone anywhere near such an unclean pagan woman. In verse 27, Jesus says to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." The Jews were the children, so they were the children of God. They were his special people. Paul says of the Israelites in Romans 9:4, he says, "To them belongs the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from their race, according to the flesh, is the Christ, who is God over all, blessed forever." That's the children, the Jews. The Gentiles, the non-Jews, were regarded by the Jews as dogs. Now, whether it is a street dog or a household pet, calling someone a dog is generally not a compliment. But look at how the woman responds to Jesus. Verse 28, she answered, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." She fully accepts that she is a Gentile dog, that she deserves nothing, that she has no rights at all as a non-Jew to expect anything from God, from Jesus, that she has no stake in God's kingdom, but she still asks that Jesus would be merciful to her, that he would allow her to eat some of the crumbs that have fallen off the children's table onto the floor. And how does Jesus respond? Well, verses 29 to 30, he accepts her and he heals her daughter. Incidentally, there is no connection between the sin in our hearts that we looked at last week and casting out a demon. So the solution to, say, pride in our hearts is not casting out a demon of pride, as some mistakenly teach. But if you had been that woman, how would you have responded to Jesus? Would you have said, "Come on, Jesus, I resent this, I resent the term dog, I find that offensive, how dare you? I've got my rights." We feel, don't we, that God owes us. He owes us a place at the table. We have this sense of entitlement, don't we? We're law-abiding, hard-working, tax-paying, responsible citizens. And this sort of whole Jew-Gentile division probably never crosses our minds. So we don't think, do we? We don't think of ourselves as being Gentiles. But in the Bible, this is a very big deal. The Old Testament is the history of God's dealings with the Jews. So they were the chosen people. Salvation was for them. And Jesus was born King of the Jews. As Gentiles, as non-Jews, we are not the children with a place at the table. We are the dogs under the table. And so we need to see ourselves as we really are. We deserve nothing from God, nothing but judgment. Our dog, Sally, not on the screen here, this is a different dog, but our dog, Sally, does not get to sit at the table with us. So during meals, we put her in a crate, and occasionally at the end of the meal, we put a dirty plate on the floor, and she's allowed to lick it clean, occasionally. But she's got no right to that. Okay, the meal is for us. The meal is for us and for our children. It's not for her. But spiritually speaking, we're Sally the Beagle. So we have no right at all to anything from the children's table. Anything we get from God is an undeserved gift. Now, it's hard, isn't it, to see ourselves that way? If we, as a family, if we fly Ryanair, we go for priority boarding. Yeah, we're used to being first in the queue, even if it's just Ryanair. But spiritually speaking, as Gentiles, we're at the back of the line. And that is very, very humbling. As created beings, we're dust. And as sinful Gentiles, we're dogs. But thank God that Jesus has come for the dogs as well. So this journey he makes into Gentile territory was no mistake. It wasn't that Jesus took a wrong turn. He didn't lose his way. He didn't sort of misread his map. He did it to make a point that he has come for the dogs too. God's salvation plan was always to reach the world, the whole world. So Genesis 12, verse 3, God promised to Abraham. He said that in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Isaiah 49, verse 6, God says to the Messiah, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. Now, yes, the Jews do still have the priority, but in God's mercy, his grace is for us Gentiles as well. So Romans 1:16, the gospel, it says, is to the Jew first and also to the Greek, that is the Gentile. Romans 11, it says that the Gentiles are wild olive branches grafted into the Jewish olive tree. Now that is something for which we should be very, very thankful. But such thankfulness comes from seeing who we are before God. We are Gentile sinners and we deserve nothing at all. So easily we see ourselves, don't we, as being the children at the table and even complaining that we don't like the food, spoiled, puffed up with this sense of entitlement before God, as if God owes us even more than what we already have. We need to see that we are the dogs under the table and we're lucky to even get the crumbs, never mind the feast we enjoy. Perhaps we should begin each Sunday service by turning to the person next to us and saying, woof, woof, as a little reminder of who we are. You heard it first here on the barge. So we are the dogs who have been fed, and second, we are the deaf who have been healed. Verse 31, after this 120-mile journey on foot through Gentile territory, taking entire Sidon, Jesus ends back in this area called the Decapolis, where the arrow is there, by the Sea of Galilee. And a man is brought to him, in verse 32, who was deaf and who had a speech impediment. Now, the two often, of course, go together, don't they? That if you can't hear, you tend not to be able to speak properly. In that culture, to be deaf and mute would have left you hopeless and helpless. Would have been pretty grim. And we may rightly pity this man. But we are more like him than we may tend to think. By nature, we are all deaf. Not physically, but spiritually. So if you look across in the next chapter, chapter 8, verse 17. 8:17, Jesus says to his disciples, do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? The disciples at this point were spiritually deaf. They had ears, but they couldn't hear. They didn't understand what Jesus was up to. And what was true of them is true of all of us spiritually by nature, that we are spiritually deaf. So this man pictures the hopelessness of our spiritual condition. Jesus said to the people back in 7:14, he said, hear me, all of you, and understand. But in our sinfulness, we don't hear, we can't hear, and we don't understand. The other week, I was trying to impress on somebody the importance of keeping to the COVID rules. But sadly, the message fell on deaf ears. We use that expression, don't we? It means that somebody doesn't get what we're saying. They ignore it. It washes over them. It goes in one ear, out the other. Well, that is how by nature we all respond to the gospel. And we'll be aware of that with people that we know, people who maybe we've told the gospel, maybe many, many times. It's been clearly explained to them, but the message has fallen on deaf ears. They just don't get it. Now, when that happens, there's nothing wrong with the message. The problem is with the reception of the message, the receiver. So it's a little bit like having a broken television. The signal that's being broadcast, that is loud and clear, but you can't receive it. And so with all of us by nature, with the gospel, we are spiritually deaf. But the good news is that Jesus has come to open deaf ears. So verse 33, you'll see that he takes the man on one side, he puts his fingers in his ears, he touches his tongue, says, be opened. And verse 35, his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And what Jesus did for that man physically, he can do for us spiritually. Any of us, all of us. So not just the Jews, but anyone. So this Decapolis area that this man was from was Gentile, that is non-Jewish territory. But only Jesus can do it. He alone has the power to open deaf ears. For someone to hear the gospel, to understand it, to receive it, it needs his supernatural intervention. It needs his touch. It needs his miracle. No wonder in verse 37, they were astonished beyond measure. He alone can make the deaf hear and the mute speak. What Jesus does here is what the Old Testament prophets foretold that God would do one day when God would come in power. So Isaiah 35 verse 5 says that on that day the ears of the deaf will be unstopped and the tongue of the mute shout for joy. Isaiah 29, a chapter from which Jesus quoted earlier in chapter 7. In Isaiah 29:18, it says, in that day the deaf shall hear the words of a book. Well, that day has now come. And it is wonderful that this day has come, but it's also humbling. It means that if you are someone today, this morning, who understands the gospel, who has received Christ, how has that happened? How is it that you get it and other people you know don't get it at all? Well, it is not that you are smarter than the rest. It's not that you're able to figure things out better than other people. It's not that you're less sinful than other people. You're just a deaf guy, a deaf girl, whom Jesus has healed. You were deaf as a doorpost, and you still would be if Jesus had not had mercy on you. Now, if that is us, our deaf ears have been opened so that our mute tongues can now speak, praising God for what he's done, telling others about him, not sort of flexing about how amazing we think we are. There's a famous hymn by Charles Wesley, which has Oath for a Thousand Tongues, and it's got this line, hear him, ye deaf, his praise, ye dumb, your loosened tongues employ. And for those we know who don't yet follow Christ, we need to recognize the problem. The problem is quite simply that they are spiritually deaf. So there's no point just shouting louder. There's no point, just trying to get them to hear by turning up the volume. Rather, as we sort of quietly share the good news with them, telling them about Jesus, explaining the word to them, we need to be praying for the Lord to open their deaf ears, to have mercy on them as he has had on us. And if you're someone here this morning, you recognize that you are spiritually deaf, why not ask God to do that for you? So who are we as believers? We are the dogs who have been fed. We are the deaf who have been healed. And lastly, we are the deprived who have been satisfied. In those days, we read 8 verse 1. Presumably in the same Decapolis region, a great crowd had gathered and had nothing to eat. Jesus tells his disciples in verses 2 and 3, he says that they've been with me now for 3 days, they have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from far away. So this big crowd are in a bad way. They're hungry. They've got nothing to eat. They're far from home. They're in a desolate place. And we may pity them, but we are more like them than we may care to think. Their physical condition pictures our spiritual condition, that by nature we are spiritually hungry and we are spiritually far from home. In the borough of Tower Hamlets in which we live, more than 40 neighbourhoods in this borough are among the 20% most deprived in the country. But we ourselves, by and large, are among the least deprived in the country, materially speaking. But spiritual deprivation is as widespread in Canary Wharf as it is in Poplar. The new Docklands developments going up all around us are full of people who are materially rich but spiritually poor, spiritually deprived, spiritually hungry, about to faint, far from home, in a desolate place, and they have nothing to eat. As one old hymn puts it, hungry and helpless, lost indeed without thee. But what Jesus did back then, he can do still today. It was a hopeless situation. There was absolutely nothing the disciples could do. So verse 4, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? But in verse 6, Jesus takes the 7 loaves, the few small fish that they have. He gives thanks, gives it to the disciples to distribute. And verse 8, we read, they ate and were satisfied. And afterwards, they pick up 7 baskets of leftovers. And verse 9 tells us there are about 4,000 people. If we believe in Christ, this is what he has done for us. We were spiritually hungry, and he's fed us. We were spiritually faint, and he has revived us. We were spiritually far from home, and he has brought us home. We were spiritually in a desolate place, and he has met our every need. Jesus has done for us what no one else could do. And what he's done for us, he wants to do for the world. Why these 2 feeding miracles? Back in chapter 6, Jesus fed 5,000 men. Now in chapter 8, he feeds 4,000 people. Why does Mark record both of these feedings? Well, because the first one was in Jewish territory and the second one was in a Gentile area. And the point is that Jesus has come not just for the Jews, but for the Gentiles, for the world. It's very noticeable how, say, Islam is kept within, by and large, within an ethnic group. So 30% of Tower Hamlets residents are Muslim, and most of them would be Bengali. In China, the Muslims are mainly the Uyghur ethnic group, distinct ethnic group. But Jesus, this is saying, has come for the world. Now, in the Old Testament, salvation was mainly for one ethnic group, the Jews. They were the ones rescued from Egypt. They were the ones fed in the wilderness. They were the ones given the promised land. They were brought back from exile. But with this Gentile, this non-Jewish feeding miracle, Jesus is telling us he's come for us too. We too get to eat our fill. He is the saviour of the world. Well, what an undeserved gift that is. Remember who we are. We are the dogs under the table, and we're lucky if we even get a few crumbs which have fallen off the table. But instead, like this crowd, we get to eat until we are satisfied. We get abundance, filled and with leftovers. And it is all of grace. Now, seeing this should make us as believers very, very thankful to God. There's no place at all for any sense of entitlement. We're just the deprived to whom, verse 2, Jesus has shown compassion. The hungry whom Jesus has fed. The far-off Gentiles who have been included and brought near. In the New Testament letters, I think probably the best commentary on this bit of Mark's Gospel would be Ephesians chapter 2. A very, very similar message in Ephesians 2. It speaks of how as Gentiles we were, in the words of 2 verse 12, separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near. And as a result, it says we are no longer strangers and aliens, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. That is quite an upgrade, isn't it? From dogs to children, children of God. And it's all of God. It's all of grace. Now, if we get this, we will be full of thanksgiving, we'll be full of humility, and we will be out without a scrap of any sense of entitlement. And, lastly, we will have compassion on other people. In 8:2, Jesus said, "I have compassion on the crowd." We saw this before, didn't we, in 6:34. The Greek word for compassion, it is about being deeply moved within, moved to action. In 1984, Bob Geldof was shocked by a BBC report about a famine in Ethiopia which had claimed 1 million lives. And there was this terribly distressing footage of starving children in this bleak African landscape. And he was moved to mobilize other big names in the music industry. And together they recorded a single called "Do They Know It's Christmas?" And the refrain of the single was "Feed the World," as on the T-shirt. And they raised £5 million for famine relief, and so Band-Aid was born. As believers, we should have that same compassion and mission to feed the world. Not just the physically hungry, though, but the spiritually hungry and helpless and lost, and far from home. And spiritual hunger is actually an even greater need, a more urgent need. Because if it's not dealt with, the spiritual hunger, it leaves people lost and far from home, not just now, but in eternity. We see pictures, don't we, of starving children, and they rightly move us. But if only we had a picture, a photograph, of somebody in hell. We may not have photographs, but we have some pretty graphic descriptions, don't we, in the teaching of Jesus. And those descriptions should move us to have compassion for a lost world. Not far from here on the Mile End Road, there is a statue of William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army. And I guess we remember William Booth mainly as someone who did an awful lot for the poor, wonderful work. But he wrote an article called "A Vision of the Lost." And this article reveals how crystal clear this guy was about the spiritual need people have and how passionate he was about saving the lost. And it's a challenging article to read, and you can find it online for free. He basically pictures people as drowning in the sea. And he saw believers as those who had made it to safety to this rock in the middle of the ocean. But what struck him most was this. He says it was the astonishing unconcern for others among many who had made it to safety on the rock. He urges us to rush to the rescue of this multitude of dying men and women. And he ends the article by saying this. He says, "You've enjoyed yourself in Christianity long enough. To go down among the perishing crowds is your duty. Going into the very jaws of hell to rescue them." And his final words are, "Now what will you do?"